Hello, and welcome to a roundtable discussion on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, I'm joined by guests for a lively conversation on a topic we hope you'll find interesting. In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay. We're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on the second book of the Lost Fleet series. And this is Lost, the Lost Fleet Fearless. There's the in front of the Lost Fleet. Lest I lose the article before the thing. This is by Jack Campbell, and it continues off of the first one, Dauntless.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say right on the heels of...
But pretty close.
Pretty close. It's not like the first one ended on a cliffhanger.
True. But this is kind of picking up the events of, and the next one made it pretty clear, we know where we're going physically.
Yeah, there's a sense of segments of the voyage, or
yes,
the journey, or the saga, however you want to put it. It's something that I don't think should have been done as like one big, huge, epic, you know, 1,000-page novel or some such. But it's got a good sense of ending with enough sense of, yep, there's something coming, and a sense of what it is, but not, oh, geez, this is exactly what it is.
Yeah.
It's not a cliffhanger.
Well, what we have in command is someone who is not bound by the interstate system in the United States to get around. He actually knows how the old country highways are set up.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I would say he knows not only the back roads or whatever, but like the Hypernet's the equivalent of the airports.
Yes.
You now no longer have to go through every city in between to get from place to place, or in this case, every star system.
Yeah.
You can go to the lesser known using the older technologies and such.
Yeah.
And he's playing cat and mouse with the opposing force of, if we go here, that's straight back home. They're gonna guess that.
Well, and at one point he talks about basically the enemy having the ability to herd them down to fewer and fewer options, and where the enemy wants them to go, to be waiting for them.
When you're stuck behind enemy lines, the assumption is you're going to beeline back home for safety. So that limits your options. And then there's only three or four places you can go, and they can narrow your choices.
Yeah.
So he's having to play a bit of a game of poker or some such against the opposing side, but also almost against his own side.
Mm-hmm.
In so much as he's playing by a different mindset.
Yes. Well, at one point, he gets accused of lying because he did something the equivalent of old school and by longhand, although he did it in his head, versus having the computer do it for him.
He had worked with enough experienced captains, commanders, admirals, etc., and had a good enough tactical sense that he was able to just think through, if I do this, they'll do that, or here's what they're going to do, and,
yeah,
you know, just kind of seat of the pants. If we go this way, we're going to lose a couple of ships each time. By this point, we'd be doomed. We're not going to make it all the way. It's too far.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a war of attrition that they'll lose.
Yeah.
But then that co-president was like, well, show me the simulations he ran. It's like, I didn't run any. I didn't need to.
Show me the paper trail.
Yeah.
Yeah, show me the proof of your work.
There's an aspect of show your work, but it'd be, if you did that to somebody in elementary school, here's some three-digit numbers, go multiply them, you'd expect them to show your work.
Yeah.
You do that to a college student.
Yes.
You know, or somebody who is just, I can do the math in my head.
But the co-president is used to dealing with the equivalent of that elementary school student.
Absolutely.
And that was what was so interesting to watch.
Well, and the relationship between the co-president and Captain Gary.
And I had seen that coming, in terms of she was the only person outside the chain of command, and he needed a personal confidant on every level.
I think the author's done a good job of planting seeds in earlier books, mm-hmm, or the earlier book.
Yes.
But even then, like the, there could be non-humans. Here we get a little bit more on that. He's...
Yes.
The story is working on multiple levels, both in terms of the novel having a beginning, middle, and end, although not a, it's over, it's done, period, the end, permanently,
right,
kind of a thing. And I think if we had started with this book and skipped the first, we would have gotten everything we had to have to get it. We wouldn't have had the context.
I don't think we would have as clear a feeling of Blackjack versus Captain John Gary.
I agree, but I think we would have had the information in the book to get a sense of it.
Yes.
But we would have had the Cliff Notes version versus having seen the first thing.
Yeah.
My point is there's an accessibility to this.
Definitely.
But there's also the benefit of reading the books.
Yeah.
In order. And when I say in order, I'm going with the chronological publication.
Yeah.
Because there's actually some prequels to Dauntless, I believe, that were written after the fact.
Interesting. Well, and that makes sense, because I can see questions like, you know, I want to know more about how he was found, and that kind of thing. So I can see where prequels came from.
Or his last adventure before.
Yeah.
It's interesting, because we had talked about a number of different book series to be reading through, and a few of them had books that were, you know, the book zero equivalent that were written after the fact, after the rest of the series.
Yeah.
And there's always the question of, well, do you start with that, or do you read it in the order it was written and published?
Yeah.
And I tend to favor the order it was written and published. And here, again, this is a good continuation of the previous story. Mm-hmm. It's got a few things that are different here. Particularly the introduction of the Fighting Falco.
I really enjoyed that for a lot of reasons.
He was a fun character, and it seemed like the author had taken everything that the co-president was warning Gary that Blackjack could be,
mm-hmm.
and kind of doing it and turning it on its head.
Yeah.
Another war hero who's in not the, oh, you want me to take command, but I will take command. They get this guy out of an Alliance prisoner camp.
Syndicate.
Prisoner camp that had Alliance prisoners. He's been prisoner for 20 years. And in my mind, the person I was kind of picturing for that was Bruce McGill.
Okay.
He was in Rizzoli Isles.
Yeah.
He was in the original MacGyver as Jack Dalton. Mm-hmm. He's been in Time Cop, a couple other things. And he's got that air. I think he could pull the character off.
Yeah.
All sides of the character, including the end game kind of a thing.
Well, it's funny, because he reminds me of a character that was in Hogan's Heroes. And I can't think of the character's name. The actor was also on Bewitched later as the doctor, the witch doctor.
I'm blanking on the doctor's name. I know who you mean.
Yeah, but he was in Hogan's Heroes. And he was, you know, the greatest colonel you've ever seen. He was the guy who was going to save the day, and he was the guy who they basically ended up working around at all times, because he actually outranked Colonel Hogan.
Mm-hmm. This was, I loved the scene when this guy is getting off the shuttle. They've just rescued him, and he's like, well, take me to whoever's in charge. And Gary's like, well, I am. It's like, well, I'm in charge now. I outrank you by date of, you know, becoming captain or whatever. And
look at me. I'm clearly older than you.
Yeah, and just the assumption. I mean, here's a guy who's been a prisoner of war for 20 years and just assumes the people who rescue him will bow to his command.
Yeah.
And Gary's like, I think you misunderstand. And then does Johnny, the captain of the Dauntless, is explaining, this is Captain Gary. It's, oh, he's related. Ah, well, whatever. And just, again, the brush off and just the self-certainty.
Yes.
And the author pulled that off very quickly, very deftly.
Yes.
Without making the character unlikable.
Well, and also did a very good job with this character of the whole, well, when the commanders of the fleet vote on this. And doing a very good job of, you know, this guy was more politician than actual skilled strategic leader. And
yes,
we saw it right from the moment we met him. He relied on charisma, not skill. And then what I loved about Gary was his response to all of this was to go look up the guy's service record and all the records they had of his battles.
To learn if the guy was good or not, because he'd already gotten the sense this guy is dangerous, just gut feeling. The co-president pretty much cleared that up, and I think it was that other captain who's been staying after at the meetings.
Duelos.
Duelos, thank you. So many names.
Yeah.
That was telling him that it would have been as effective and simpler if he just ordered his ships to ram the other ones, because there were that many losses on both sides.
Yes.
And that's when Gary started doing his research and knowing what to look for.
Yes.
Was able to see the pattern and such.
Yeah.
But when Falco took off with 40 ships, I'm like, okay, the end game is going to be when they come back and they've got a Falco mess has to be cleaned up.
Well, and one of the things I really respected about the Gary character is, as he's trying to order the ships back to the fleet, he's trying to get them to not go on what he believes is a suicide break. The last message he sends when he realizes is they're not going to respond, there's nothing I can do, he tells them a meetup point.
Yeah, he tells them the name of a system that they can get to and he can get to, because he's thought through the route they're taking and decided against it because it's suicide.
Yes.
Know the route he's going to take and how they could meet up. And yes. Again, it shows the chess player thinking a couple of moves ahead.
And the leave no man behind, even those who mutiny.
Yeah.
And the recognition that it may not be 100% of the crew that mutinied. It was the captains in the command chairs.
Well, and later on, when they've had their battle against the shipyards or whatever,
yeah.
And they've had some wins and stuff like that, and then they're meeting up to where these people may go, he's got a game plan. He's all set to essentially rescue them, knowing they're going to be coming running. And the state the ships come back in, the number of ships that come back.
Yeah.
It was all, I think, it was foreshadowed, not telegraphed.
Yes.
And the author is doing a brilliant job on that stuff of giving us a sense of these characters, how they think, how they act.
Well, and giving us Gary's fears, doubts, self-doubts in those internal monologues that, because they've got so much character and personality to them, they play really well.
Well, but also the co-president's fears about Gary being this legendary blackjack.
Yeah.
Or in some ways, exactly, in other ways, inversely, personified by the Fighting Falco.
Yes. We begin to understand her fears and why she didn't get to know the man she instantly feared.
Yeah.
And as she's gotten to know the man, and, you know, somebody actually asks him at one point, did she say she hates you?
Yeah.
Which was kind of funny, and he's like, oh, wait, I may have attributed that to her based on how she interacts with me.
Well, and there was also a line on how he was never afraid he was going to use her first name on the bridge because she acted so differently.
Yes.
It may as well have been two different people.
Yeah.
And there are ways that we are having things shown,
mm-hmm.
and when they tell us, we see it, you know what I mean?
Well, and at one point when she's hammering home the point of basically, were you prepared for all those civilians to die? Did you realize what your order would mean? And he turns to her with kind of a, you know, if you were trying to keep me honest, you've made that point and succeeded.
Well, because that was when he had asked one of the ships to volunteer.
Yes.
And she's like, that's as good of an order.
Yes.
And he's kind of like, I know that. And he walks the line of, he's a military man. He's going to give people commands that are going to get both them and other people killed.
Yes.
He doesn't relish any of that. He's going to try to get as many survivors back. And it's clear from his actions that, like, when one of the ships had clearly stayed behind to protect others and whatnot.
Yes.
And when some of the damaged ships failed to kind of line up with the fleet, it's like, hey, they'll protect us, let's run.
Yes.
But others didn't.
Yeah.
He's like, you're too damaged. Get over there. Get safe. But I acknowledge what you were trying to do, and I respect that.
I respect that. And here's what you can do if worse comes to worse, and we do need your firepower.
Yeah. And he showed them with a great deal of respect.
Yeah.
Also, when one of the captains that had gone with the Falco fleet came back, and at the end of the meeting, he's like, well, what about us?
Yes.
He or she, I forget. And Gary's response is, well, you're owning up to your mistakes.
Yes.
I respect that.
Owned up to your mistakes and didn't leave the one ship that was floundering.
Yes.
To flounder alone. You behaved with honor on the way to the return.
You made a mistake.
Yes.
You clearly regret it.
Yeah.
You are owning up to that and willing to give up your command based on that.
Yes.
So you're taking responsibility for it. There's a lot of aspects of how the different characters act.
Yeah. Numos never owned up to making a mistake. In fact, he was crying for, give us our court-martial. We can defend ourselves and prove we did the right thing.
Yes, we were just following orders, was essentially.
Yes, yes.
You know. He had an excuse for everything.
We were told we were a diversion. Yeah.
Well, and it's funny because other ships had been, by that point, used as a diversion. And Gary had told everybody up front, they're going to do this.
Yes, yeah.
So one would think nobody in that virtual conference would have given that any credence.
Yeah. Well, and there were several times where the author had Gary basically clenching his fist and wanting to reach for the communications button, wanting to micromanage, but knowing he shouldn't.
Well, because of the time lag and other stuff, one of the lines around that I really loved was that Gary had always wondered why there were no controls on this one section of the chair.
Yes.
And he realized it was left plain so he could pound it.
Yes. Yes.
There was I loved that line because it shows a level of, I don't want to say forethought, but it implies that the people who built the ship knew the captains, knew it was going to happen, knew there'd be frustration, and you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's a little detail that really rounds out the world nicely.
Yeah. Well, one of the lines I appreciate from Gary is when he was giving the Marine colonel some instructions. And he's like, trying not to micromanage her, trying to trust her judgment. And he's like, you know, I'm not going to tell you precisely how long to give, but make sure you give the civilians enough time to flee, but don't give the enemy enough time to attack you.
Yeah, do it quickly, but not too fast.
Yeah, kind and of then a- right after that, he puts in the internal monologue, I always hated receiving contradictory orders like that. I need to follow this up with something more definitive.
Yeah, that's where the internal dialogue really helps, because you could see he's realized, oh crap, I shouldn't have said that.
Well, it's more that I couldn't have said that. It was a genuine, I hated orders like that when I was in that level of command, and I'm not going to be the kind of commander I hated.
And he follows it up, how about 30 minutes? And the guy, the response is, how about 15? He's like, 15 it is.
Yeah.
Kind of, okay, we've negotiated, and he's always clear with his captains and stuff. If you have questions, ask. If you don't agree, ask.
Yes.
And when we got to the bit about the Hypergate and how you could take it down and how the feint was going to go this way, and the captain was like, nobody's going to buy that.
Yes.
Today's situation is thus. And he's like, well, this is what I'm trying to do. What do you suggest?
Well, and that was another point where the internal monologue helped, because he was sitting there going, she interrupted me and I wanted to get mad. But as I listened to the interruption, I realized she wasn't saying, I don't want to obey. She was saying, your order won't work because,
yep.
Can we improve it? So that really worked. And I loved when we went down to the intelligence department for the interrogations.
Mm-hmm.
I loved, first of all, that they decided torture doesn't work, but they had better means. I loved how we dealt with the prisoners, but I also liked when he came out from having dealt with the prisoner, and somebody was very tentative about saying, we could do this. And he was saying, look, I realize my form of command is different than what you've had before, but I want to hear your ideas.
Yeah.
And again, we had that internal monologue saying, I've never heard from this department before. I need to fix that.
Well, and there was one line, it might have been around that point, where it was, don't assume I don't want to hear the idea or that I'll reject the idea. Tell me, and I may decide to reject it, but I want to hear it.
Yes.
It really gave a sense of his command style.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because a lot of the characters in the book, there are a lot of watch standards.
Yeah.
Standards, I think.
Standards.
And other, you know, the guy at this desk, unnamed people.
Yes, yes.
That are in some cases filling vital plot roles but don't need names or whatever. In other words, we've been on the bridge of the Dauntless now for 2 books.
Yeah.
And aside from Gary, Disjani, and the co-president, I don't know we could name a single person up there.
And the funny thing is, I'm okay with that because that means that the author isn't having to constantly tell us, Sulu finally got a break from the bridge and somebody took his place, because it's just the watchstander on duty.
Well, the other thing it's telling us is, unlike a typical Star Trek show or some such where it's the bridge crew,
mm-hmm.
This is operating at a level higher. It's the captains. It's that yes. level of the fleet.
Yes.
That are the players.
Well, and I like how they've set it up to where this is very clearly Desjani's ship. And we have our captain, who is the equivalent of the admiral, sitting next to her, but in kind of a secondary seat. She's front and center.
It's a very different dynamic than any time an admiral's been on the Enterprise in a Star Trek show.
Yes, yes. To the point that when he wants to address her ship, when he wants to go ahead and take full command of her ship, which very rarely happens, he defers to her for a moment of, do you mind, basically. Because again, he wants to treat her with respect on her ship.
Yes.
And that was something back in book one, when the co-president was saying, why isn't the captain like me? You need to respect her space. You need to respect her ship, her realm of authority.
Well, and when Gary was asking, does Johnny, I think it was about Falco, actually. And she was like, because when they met up at the shuttle bay, it was the first time he'd been back to the shuttle bay since he'd gotten command of the fleet, actually.
Yeah.
And Gary, before that, it's like, hey, you're doing a great job with the ship. I appreciate, you know, very complimentary. But it was from a spot of having worked side by side with her now for months.
Well, and having realized how much had happened since he'd last been in that place.
Out comes Falco. Oh, what a brave warrior. You're on a tight ship. He's been on the ship for 30 seconds.
Yes.
And she's like, he's trying to buy me off of flattery, you know? And her opinion of the two war heroes.
Yes.
And her ability to articulate it.
Yes.
Was good.
Yeah. She flat out said, you know, you don't give false flattery. You aren't trying to manipulate people. When you praise us, we know we've earned it.
There was also a line in the internal monologue at one point that he was saying, the minute I've lost her respect or something, I've gone too far kind of a thing.
Yes.
Which I'm wondering is foreshadowing.
I have to wonder, too. Well, and he has had quite a bit of concern about the co-president and the relationship they've got in terms of, is she just biding her time with me, or...
Does she love me, or is she going to knife me in the back in the middle of the night?
There was that precise sentence. But there was also the, she's a politician. Does she see coming home with me as a way to elevate her status once she gets there, or as a way to control me if I try to take too much power when I get there?
Keep your friends close and the enemies closer kind of mindset.
Yeah.
He does not know where he stands with her.
Yeah.
And neither do we, because the novel is from his perspective.
Well, and I can't help but wonder if that conversation he walked around the corner and caught the arguing of with Des Johnny, and he couldn't get Des Johnny to open up about later, I think the co-president's husband is in one of those POW camps. And I think that because Des Johnny said she was going to keep going through the list of prisoners that were still alive as of 3 years ago.
I was wondering what that fight was about, and I hadn't thought about that. She mentioned her husband that she still loved.
Yes.
And I couldn't recall what his fate was.
He had died in the war 10 years ago.
All right. So he easily could be alive and as a prisoner.
Mm-hmm. And Des Johnny could be pretty pissed if she's not being honest.
Kind of a, you've got to tell Gary this.
Yeah.
Interesting. Because that was as close to a cliffhanger as the book kind of ended on, of this Johnny and the co-president were clearly not seeing eye to eye, or very much at a hostile engagement kind of a thing.
Well, when the co-president and Gary reached a truce, because they went through the emotional roller coaster after, and she accused him of a personal betrayal.
Yes.
And manipulation, which was part of it. But when they kind of came down, she's like, okay, I wronged you by jumping to conclusions. And they reached their truce, and Des Johnny realized that all that tension had been broken, and that Gary was happier and more relaxed, and was able to be better on the bridge because of it. She started treating the co-president with respect for the first time.
And something had changed, and you're right, the existence of their acquisition of a 3-year-old prisoner list was one of the things.
Yeah.
I'm curious where that goes in the next book.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I was grateful for in this book was I had feared that Fearless would follow a different ship.
I was unclear if we were going to jump ships, if we were going to jump time frames, different characters, or what. And this did a nice continuation of the story without feeling like part one, part two.
Yeah.
Or, you know, again, a cliffhanger of, geez, I didn't get a complete book.
Yeah. Well, the first book felt like a first season, if you will. And it was really John Gary's coming into his own, probably confidence-wise, as the commander, and accepting that he was the commander of the fleet.
Getting his feet back under him, essentially.
Yeah. You know, the second book was a season of fighting Falco.
Well, his first major challenge to his command.
Mm-hmm. From within.
And without. I would say the battles and stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, we had some pretty good battles in book one.
Yeah, but I don't think any of them were of the sort with the shipyard and the clear victory and polish that this one had.
Well, and this one also had kind of a, the syndics are catching on, they're learning from our tactics, they're preparing for us. Yeah.
Yeah. But I thought the shipyard, and then when they reunited with the fleet of the Falco group, that both of those were good fights.
Yeah.
And again, I'm liking the Starship fleet level maneuvers.
Yes.
We're getting good descriptions of them. It's not overdone or underdone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one that if they were to do it as like a TV show or a movie, or TV show really, I think, given the pacing, the way it should be done, how they could pull that off, having the sense of hurry up and wait, and the time lag kind of stuff, versus the, I think, natural desire for a TV show to be a bit more, you know, interactive, if you will, in the fight, and a bit more immediate.
Yeah.
And I would hope if they turn this into a TV show that they keep the sense of pacing and it being a, for lack of a better term, a turn-based strategy game than an arcade game.
Yes.
You know, one of those things where you see them fire off the volley of missiles, and it may be two or three commercial breaks before they land.
Yeah. And they do a really good job in the book of giving you that sense of, we've plotted it out. Well, we found out at one point that the syndics who aren't on the ships can take control of the ships remotely if they think the ships aren't going to follow commands. He's like, well, if the people on board don't have control, then we know where the ships are going to go. We know where the people with the time lag need to send them.
They can't adapt fast enough to what we can do out there because they don't have the information yet.
Yeah. So we can target our weapons to where we know they have to end up.
There's a lot of aspects of Gary herding the enemy fleet where he needs them to be and where he's prepared for them.
Yeah.
Which, again, I enjoy that level of gamesmanship or chess or whatever you want to call it.
Well, and at one point the enemy leaves some mines for us, and later on it's, I think we should do the enemy what they did to us back at Sutra. And that took me a second. Like, okay, a lot happened back at Sutra. What are we referencing?
There have been a couple of times where they reference a past battle, and it's like, wait, which of the five or whatever we've gone through?
Well, and I mean, each battle is not one incident, because the battles are named by the star system.
And they usually have a battle or two in the star system as they're coming and going, yeah.
Yeah.
In this book, we got a little bit of, I don't say technobabble or whatever, but more detail about the star, or the hypernet.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff, how they travel that way and the ramifications of that. We also get a lot more progression on the, there could be non-human life on the other side of the Syndic.
And they could be devious.
Yes. I'm of the opinion that the war between the two sides was instigated by a third party.
And I think you're onto something.
And I like how there's enough to chew on in terms of what's really going on, because we're getting the breadcrumbs.
Yes.
And it's not just a thump, here it is.
Yeah.
So I think the author's doing a really good job of a steady release of information in terms of characterization, plot, science, and politics or whatever. And there's still a lot of major unknowns. I mean, we know nothing about the actual Alliance. Maybe they're the bad guys by Gary's standards.
Well, that's been one of the interesting things, is his frustration when they pick up information at places with how outdated the information is and how hard it's been to get the information he wants.
Yeah.
And I've found that intriguing and have wondered what that's foreshadowing. If that's letting us know if only he'd known something sooner, or what?
It could be that, or it could just as easily be the author not wanting to deal with that until he's got a better sense of where he wants to go with it.
And that could be.
Because I don't know how many more books it would take to get this fleet home.
And I've wondered that too. Because I'm enjoying the journey. I'm enjoying the Frogger kind of hopscotch to it. And the fact that sometimes you have to go backwards to go forwards.
It would be disappointing if in a single book or two they'd gotten home too fast.
Yeah.
If it takes 30 books too slow.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a balancing act to be had there. And I'm curious how that plays out.
Well, I've loved watching Desjani's attitudes grow and evolve under the influence of Gary.
Mm-hmm.
And part of me wants to see more of that ripple effect through the fleet. She's kind of the representative of the fleet.
I get the sense we're seeing some of that here and there when he's talking with other crew members, etc. But it's one that it's not suddenly she's, you know, flipped a light switch and she thinks differently. We're seeing it incrementally.
Yes.
And there are some writers, the two camps tend to be pantsers and plotters. Seat of the pants, wing it, and plot, you know, plan it out.
Yeah.
And this writer seems to be more of a plotter than a pantser, because there seems to be a definite plan that he's following.
Well, early on, Desjani was basically a kill any syndic you come across.
Mm-hmm.
The only good syndic is a dead syndic. But by the end of this book, she has reached, well, not even the end, probably three quarters of the way through, she's come to understand why Gary says hitting a ship where the crew can't even control the ship and they're unwilling targets, it's murder.
It's one thing to fight somebody who can fight back. It's another thing to just slaughter somebody who's helpless.
Yes.
And he's
reteaching the Alliance that difference.
Yeah. Well, and also giving them often a chance to surrender, not always.
Yes.
And how to be humane. And yeah, that may not be what the other side would do, but isn't that why we're fighting them?
Yes. And I love the way he's made those points. We're fighting them because we're not them, not because we want to become them.
Yeah. He's getting the honor back into the fleet.
Yeah.
And trying to respect their current traditions and aspects and mindset as much as he can.
Well, and one of the ways I really respected him for doing that was when he gave honors to all the people on one of Falco's mutiny ships. Kind of those people just by the seat of their pants just barely got one of those ships back.
Yeah, it was the ship that he was amazed was still running.
Yeah.
And gave them high marks for, you got the ship back, you've protected other ones, you took a beating for somebody else's mistakes.
Yeah.
And there was one line, it's like, I don't know if it's proper to give a crew that abandoned or mutinied or whatever an honor. He's like, I don't care.
Yes.
They deserve it.
Yeah.
He's good about praising when it needs to be and is appropriate, not overpraising.
Yes.
Yeah. You can see enough of the mindset and the behavior that could have easily led to the Blackjack Gary legend.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's unearned. It was just stories evolve.
Yes.
I'm curious if at some point there are books that go back the 100 years.
Yeah, that would be fun.
So, because there's at least 12 books in this series. Some of them are Lost Fleet. Some of them have another kind of a subtitle or whatever. So I'm not sure the grouping of them all.
Interesting. Yeah, I want to keep reading. I'm enjoying the series a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Again, I was worried it would be something we'd have to slog through. And it's just, yeah, it didn't quite work, but okay.
Well, some of the stories I read are so devoted to making sure the plot happens that they kind of shortchange you on the characters. And some are so focused on giving you well-rounded characters that the plot is kind of just barely there. And this has a great balance.
It's got a good balance on plot, characterization, and there are some scenes that are clearly a bit more plot-heavy or, you know, battle-heavy or whatever. Others that are a little bit more character-heavy, but never a scene that is only one-sided.
Yeah.
Because usually it's like, well, if I do this with the fleet, geez, do I got to worry about this captain or that captain or,
mm-hmm.
or whatever?
Well, and there were some interesting bits of the, you know, I keep telling them you have to trust me, and here we are in battle, and with the time lag, I'm having to remind myself to trust them. That was
and
well
sometimes
done.
Being pleasantly surprised.
Yes. And that was nice to see, both in terms of they're clearly learning from him and learning the tactics he's teaching.
And not just the tactics, but the inherent lesson around them.
Yes.
And with the ships that came back, he was very clear that most of them, the captains, would keep their command. There were a couple that clearly wouldn't, the instigators of the mutiny particularly. But he was very clear, I'm going to be keeping an eye on you.
Yeah.
If the burden of command's too much, say so.
Yes.
But I'm giving you a second chance, don't blow it.
Yeah.
So I'm expecting one or two of those to kind of become a staunch ally
mm-hmm.
of Gary in the next book or two or three or what have you. It just seems like they've broken away, they've learned their lesson, they come back.
Well, they've learned lessons the hard way.
Yeah.
And they'll be our avenue to learn what they learned while they were away.
It would be interesting if we got a book that told what happened to Falco's fleet.
Yeah.
I don't know that I need that at this point. If I were to do that for one of those, I would do it with one of the ships that didn't make it.
Yes.
You know, one of the ones that almost made it to the gate, but not quite.
Yeah.
Because those are the ones most likely to have learned Gary's lessons and have an interesting story to tell.
Yeah, I agree.
But again, so far, both books, very much from Gary's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's sometimes internal monologue, sometimes it's slightly removed, but it never leaves him.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, when one of them starts to do that, how will that work?
Yeah, I agree. I'm curious.
Because you got to have an interesting character or group of characters to go follow.
Yeah. And at this point, we don't know enough about Duello's personality. I mean, we know that he was one of the ones who was saying things like, if Falco had been rescued before you were, mm-hmm. situation would have been different, and things like that.
Yeah. I'm curious what the end game is with that character.
Yeah, me too.
I'm hoping it's not a die gloriously in battle before they get home, but you never know.
Yeah, sadly, I think a few more people will have to die before we get home.
Oh, absolutely. The fleet's not going to go unscathed. It lost a number of ships this time, not even counting Falco's group that left and came back demolished. But it's... I'm curious, again, the pacing of the novels. Is this one where another couple of novels were back home and the next adventure begins, or what?
Yeah.
And I don't know which way I would want it to go. Because, again, there's a certain amount of play it out, don't rush it.
Yeah.
But if you're going to do that, always have something to tell.
Well, in the Star Trek Voyager series, we always have a very clear idea how far from home we were.
Yeah, but the difference is there when you start a TV series with, okay, we've gone to the far reaches of space, now we got to go home. You know they're not getting home till the end of the the series.
I guess my point was that here, I mean, I know we went to the Syndic home system, but I just don't have a clear concept of distance in this universe.
Yeah. How big is that space? How deep were they really into it? Are they on one edge of it, you know?
Yeah.
Dead center, what? And they raised the possibility they may actually continue not only deeper into, but beyond.
Yeah.
I just don't think they do it at this point. I don't know. They easily could turn that around next book or two. So I'm enjoying this. It's a good read. It's a lot of fun. Again, I picked the Dauntless one because I'd read the miniseries from Titan and enjoyed it. And I think they're doing a great job with both the comics and now, again, with the novels. I want to keep going with these.
Yeah, I agree.
So anything else?
Nope, I think you're good.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.